Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll take a closer look at what's included in the state's new education report card. We'll also find out what happens when students don't get vaccinated. How is Illinois stacking up to other states when it comes to the legal system and the impact that has on low-income people?
You end up with many people who can't afford to pay, especially as government is relying heavily on fines and fees as a means of generating revenue.
Chicago police solve less than half of the murders committed in that city. The rate is even lower in African American communities. We'll hear a report. And a plan to recognize some of the great musical talent that has come from the state of Illinois. All that and more ahead on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, does a new law in Illinois make the legal system more financially onerous on low-income individuals? We'll also hear about a lawsuit involving a school district and a facility that helps care for severely disabled students, and later building a rock and roll museum along Route 66. That and a whole lot more this week on Statewide. First up today, among the nation's largest cities, Chicago stands out for its high murder rate and the number of cases that go unsolved. In recent years, Chicago police have been solving or clearing, as they say, about 4 out of 10 murders. An analysis by member station WBEZ of that data shows another dimension of the dismal rate. The number solved is especially low when the victims are African American. Chip Mitchell tells us more.
There were 849 murders from the beginning of last year through this past July. By the end of that period, CPD had solved only a fraction of them. And here's the racial disparity. When the victim was white, 47% of murders were solved. For Hispanics, the rate was about 33%. When the victim was African American, it was less than 22%. What that means is this. When a black Chicagoan got murdered, the odds CPD would solve the crime were less than half of when the victim was white. One of the neighborhoods suffering from a lot of violence is Austin. I visited a church there, Greater St. John Bible Church. I talked to some members.
Hi, my name is Sharon Jones. I'm a retired truck driver. I drove semi-tractor trailers for 25 years.
Jones says a first cousin of hers was killed just blocks from the church a few years ago, a murder that was never solved.
My name is Bernard Lilly Jr., 23-year-old. I'm a musician, as well as I'm a school-based mentor for college mentoring experience.
Both Jones and Lilly said the racial disparity in murder clearances does not surprise them.
I think it's a testament to how disposable black bodies and black lives are in this country. The crime rates are so high because of systematic racism.
Also, the resources that come to the black community, jobs, is systematic.
Lilly says he thinks it can be hard for police to solve murders in some African-American neighborhoods because witnesses don't want to help the police. And he says he understands why.
There's definitely fear, and I feel like there's fear of not being protected. So if a detective comes to my house and wants certain information, people know that you're here. Now I'm a target. And what does that mean for me and my family?
Yeah, and a lot of times criminals are harbored by family members. That keeps it going too. You know, when you have family members letting killers eat at their table.
But Jones and Lilly say there are things CPD could do to solve more murders involving black victims. One, the department could hire more black detectives.
It's important for detectives to meet the people where they are. You know, it'll be a lot easier if it's a detective that identifies with my experience.
Two, they say CPD's detectives could just work harder.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the word that's ringing in my ear is accountability.
If their check was tied to how many crimes they solve, more crimes would be solved.
But Yesenia Pizarro doesn't buy it.
The research does not support that notion.
She's an Arizona State University criminologist.
One of the things we know about clearance when you're a detective is that that's your performance metric. That's how the higher-ups within the police department will assess if you're an actual good detective or a bad detective. So it's not so much that detectives are not putting in the effort. What the research suggests is that some cases are just harder to clear than others.
Pizarro says police need people willing to come forward with information and witnesses willing to cooperate.
If you have a community that, because of prior experiences, doesn't trust the police, it doesn't matter if you're an African-American detective. You're a police officer. They might not trust you and they might not talk to you.
Trust. This is something the city of Chicago has wrestled with for a long time. The issue has been especially acute in the last few years since the shooting of Laquan McDonald by police officer Jason Van Dyke. There have been reform efforts. The U.S. Department of Justice investigated CPD. There's a federal lawsuit requiring police reforms, new directives from the superintendent of police. It's a massive undertaking. But Tenney Gross says there are actually some pretty simple ways police detectives could start earning trust. Gross heads the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago, a group that works with gang members in Austin.
Those in power, we need to go the extra mile to serve the communities. It starts with the mothers.
Mothers of the murder victims.
Many complain they don't really get regular calls back and relationship building with the family.
Calls back from detectives.
To earn trust is a very difficult thing, and every field has to do it. Medicine, street outreach, social workers, teachers, and police. We cannot whine about it. We're paid by the taxpayers.
I asked for an interview with someone from the Chicago Police Department to talk about why murders involving white victims are twice as likely to be solved as murders involving black victims. The interview request was not granted. A police spokesman sent a statement that says the department is committed to investigating and solving all crimes regardless of a victim's race or any other demographic trait. When Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson has talked about CPD's failure to solve murders, he's often emphasized the issue of witnesses.
You very rarely have a police officer that actually witnesses a murder or a shooting. We need the public's help in solving these crimes.
Without witnesses, without trust in the police in neighborhoods like Austin, there won't be much official justice. There will be street justice. Sharon Jones, the retired truck driver, she tells what that looks like.
It's like a free-for-all. You know, you shot my cousin, I'm going to come and shoot your uncle, and, you know, just back and forth. And there's an 80% chance that you're going to get away. So what's the point of thinking about the police going to catch me, because everybody already knows that they're not.
A police spokesman says an outside group is studying the department's detective bureau, that the study will be done soon, and that the public will get to see the conclusions. Chip Mitchell, WBEZ News.
Critics have said the legal system hurts low and moderate income people more than rich ones. Fines and fees can pile one upon the other and hurt the ability of poor people to access transportation, employment, even basic shelter. That was supposed to change this year. Before leaving office, former Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner signed the Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act into law. But after going into effect in July of this year, some believe the bipartisan measure places disproportionate burdens on low-income people in Illinois and can contribute to poverty. Mary Cullen is with member station WGLT, and she talked with some national experts on how Illinois matches up with the rest of the country and whether this state can learn from those examples.
Lisa Foster is co-director of the Fines and Fees Justice Center, a national organization that tracks court costs around the U.S. Foster says that Illinois' Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act may look like it could work on paper, but in the real world, not so much.
Generally speaking, the fact that judges now can waive or reduce fines and fees for criminal offenses and can consider up to 400% of poverty is great, but by excluding traffic, you're excluding a huge number of people who are caught in the justice system and for whom even a traffic fine and associated fees jeopardizes their economic security.
Foster's co-director at the Fines and Fees Justice Center, Joanna Weiss, adds that for many, traffic offenses are often the entry point into the legal system.
People start out with a low-level traffic offense that nobody feels should result in jail time or perpetual punishment, but because enforcement is so heavily done in poor communities and communities of color, you end up with many people who can't afford to pay, especially as government is relying heavily on fines and fees as a means of generating revenue.
Even a small fine can have long-lasting impacts on low-income residents. Kai Ajay, a leader of Bloomington's Black Lives Matter, says one unpaid fine could increase time without a driver's license or result in jail time. Ajay says the more time passes, the harder it is for the offender to find money to pay the court costs. Lisa Foster agrees.
For even a minor traffic violation, $226 at Illinois' minimum wage is 27 hours of work. So you're asking people who are working at minimum wage, assuming they're working, to give up almost a week's salary or income for a speeding ticket.
McLean County judges say excluding waivers for traffic offenses is a way to fund the court system. Other provisions of the reform measure did reduce fines and fees, tied them closer to the offense instead of funding unrelated agencies, and offered waivers for low-income people. The act's sponsor, former Representative Steven Anderson, calls leaving out traffic offenses from waivers a practical choice.
That is such a large volume court call. The clerks felt that if we applied the waiver to the traffic court system, the system would become unmanageable, because then you'd have to have a hearing for so many cases that at this stage, at least, they felt that that would just be unmanageable from a paperwork standpoint.
Anderson says lawmakers drafting the bill had to face a reality. Ben Riddell is an attorney with the ACLU of Illinois. He differs with Anderson. Riddell says courts exist to create justice, not to make the job of those working in the system easier.
They've got it backwards. The rules and the laws of the state of Illinois are not here to make the court's jobs easier and to reduce the amount of work that they have to do. That's not the goal. That's not any kind of a public policy goal.
Riddell says it's time to find a better public policy solution.
These fines and fees are perverting court's ability to do justice. So the fact that some clerks think that it's too much work to allow judges to waive financial assessments for low-income people who are suffering because of these assessments, that's just unacceptable.
In states like Illinois, where the state does not fully fund courts, fines and fees are a common way to pay for court operations. Lisa Foster with the Fines and Fees Justice Center shares statistics from a recent Governing.com report, which found that Illinois has 33 jurisdictions that derive over 10% of their revenue from fines, fees, and forfeitures, 11 jurisdictions that derive over 20%, 4 jurisdictions that derive over 30%, and 1 that derives over 50%.
That makes Illinois certainly, in fact, number 10 in the country among states that derive a significant percentage of their revenue from fines and fees.
Foster says there are 70 jurisdictions in Illinois that earn more than $100 for every adult resident in fines and fees. She says there are better methods to fund court systems. Foster notes a 1990s pilot program that proved when fine and fee amounts are scaled to offender income, people are more willing and able to pay. Foster says the 2014 shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, sparked interest by states and municipalities on the issue of fines and fees. A week after Brown's death, a report found the city of just over 21,000 people brought in $2.6 million in fines and fees in 2013. That's $124 for every adult resident in Ferguson. The report added fuel to the existing protest over racial aspects of Brown's killing. Foster says media coverage may have scared some jurisdictions into finding a better funding option. In 2017, for example, Foster says Texas passed a law regarding fine-only cases, where the penalty is a fine with no possibility of incarceration. She says Texas judges must assess an offender's ability to pay before sentencing.
If they determine that the person cannot afford the amount of fines and fees that would ordinarily be imposed, the judge can waive or reduce the fines and fees. convert those fines and fees to community service, put the person on a payment plan, or any combination of those.
Foster says within 1 year, Texas saw the amount the courts collected went up, even though the overall fines and fee amounts went down.
That's, we think, because when people can actually imagine paying the amount that's imposed because it's based on their economic circumstances, and you give them a reasonable payment plan, a way to pay it, they do.
Foster says when payment feels impossible, offenders are much more likely to throw their hands up and walk away because they know it's out of reach. When that happens, the court often gets no money at all. San Francisco provides another example. Foster says the West Coast city eliminated a range of fees and implemented a low-income payment plan. She says the city collected almost three times as much in court costs. Foster says jurisdictions often don't give the policy a chance because on the surface it looks counterintuitive. And after so many years of things just being that way, many jurisdictions are reluctant to change. Foster's co-director has a more controversial explanation of why counties, states, and municipalities don't embrace income-based fines and fees. Joanna Weiss says the issue lies in the model of self-funded courts.
When you have actors in the court whose salaries are dependent on money coming in from fines and fees, they're terrified of making any changes that are going to affect their budgets.
Weiss says no one in the court should have their paycheck tied to the fines and fees they assign to offenders, despite it being a common practice across the U.S. Mark Fellheimer, the chief judge for McLean County, says raising funds for the courts is not on any judge's mind. They're just doing their job.
When I impose a fine or I impose an assessment, we impose what's appropriate. We deal with the ability to pay as part of that, as well as a waiver. So it's touchy to start saying that if judges are involved as far as the system itself, yes, we are, but I don't view it as we're attempting to collect money for the court system.
Fellheimer says the law itself was not written by judges, and they have to abide by the statute. He says a judge's primary concern is implementing the law as intended, which he says McLean County's judges are doing well. Supporters of change might have another bite at the apple. The new Criminal and Traffic Assessment Act that took effect in July is a trial run. It sunsets after a year and a half. The Illinois General Assembly will review court revenue data next spring to see whether policymakers think the law is working.
That's Mary Cullen with member station WGLT, and she prepared a series as part of a John J. Arnold Fines and Fees Justice Reporting Fellowship project. You can listen to all of that series. There's a link at statewideshow.com. Up next, what some newly compiled data from the State Board of Education tells us, and later, rock and roll along Route 66. More of Statewide still to come. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, the latest school report card for the state of Illinois is out. We'll find out what you can learn from it. And later, Illinois' rock and roll heritage will soon be on display in a new museum. That's all to come on Statewide. Next, under federal law, every child is entitled to an education, even children with special needs. And if they can't be taught in regular school, districts have to pay extra to have the students taught in private facilities. Now, one district has disenrolled 10 students to avoid paying those costs, and it's led to a legal battle. Our Education Desk reporter Dusty Rhodes explains.
With most lawsuits, you can read the pleadings and decide who's the bad guy. But in this case, I can't find a bad guy. The plaintiff represents 10 children with profound disabilities. The defendant is one of the poorest school districts in the state. That's the West Harvey Dixmoor Elementary District. It's 20 miles south of Chicago in a suburb Wikipedia bluntly describes as suffering from high levels of unemployment, poverty, and crime. The students in this lawsuit reside within one of the few businesses in Harvey, Children's Habilitation Center. I asked CEO Pamela Markle to explain the name.
Habilitation is where you try to prevent further contractures. You're never going to get back to a so-called normal state. It is working with them to help prevent more deterioration.
All 65 residents are on feeding tubes. Most use wheelchairs, and a majority depend on ventilators. But despite the medical machinery that surrounds and sustains them, there's no forgetting that they're children. And like most kids, they spend their days in school. A few, like the 4-year-old girl who asked about my headphones, are transported daily to outside schools. But most residents at Children's Habilitation Center, or CHC, have the kind of complex physical needs that require constant access to medical staff. So they attend class inside the facility, where education is tailored to their developmental levels. With older kids, that might involve assistive technology.
Juan, have you trick-or-treated?
Yes. But with younger children, it can be as simple as sensory exposure, like mixing food coloring with shaving cream, digging the seeds out of a pumpkin, or putting their hands into a bin of uncooked rice.
You know, for us it feels cool, but for them it feels a little different. So
Jane Lurquin, who has a doctorate in special education, directs the classes at CHC.
I have one that he never moved. Now when you say his name, he lifts his head up and looks for you. There's another one that she's now starting to hold my finger a little, but she also learned how to turn her monitor on and beep when I leave. We've had a couple that actually moved out because they have progressed enough to move back to the family.
Under Illinois state law, each CHC resident's home school district covers part of their tuition. And last year, per usual, West Harvey Dixmoor was one of 9 districts paying tuition for CHC residents. But this year, Harvey's new superintendent, Janetta Miller, kicked most CHC students off its rolls. William Gleason is the attorney for the school district.
Mrs. Miller, within her fiduciary responsibilities for the Board of Education, observed the amount of money that was being spent to CHC, and she did raise concerns of there's several $100,000 going out. Is this money that we should be spending?
You can't blame her for trying to save money. Despite an increase in state dollars brought about by the new funding formula, the district continues to be one of the very poorest in the state, with just 62% of the funds it needs to meet adequacy. CHC has filed a lawsuit against Harvey Schools, as well as the State Board of Education, asking it to decide who pays tuition for these children. The case hinges on where the parents live and getting them to enroll their children in those districts to make them pay for the tuition. But Markle, the CEO, says that's easier said than done.
Most of our clientele, the parents are in poverty. They have issues of their own. We only have about 10 children that have parents involved. We really are their family.
The State Board of Education is expected to issue a decision this week. Meanwhile, CHC is continuing to educate all school-age residents. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
The Illinois State Board of Education has released its new report card. The name makes it sound like it gives schools a grade, which it does. But it has more than just test scores, and Dusty Rhodes joined me to explain some of the data.
So the report card is an online site that you can go to find out anything you could possibly want to know with the possible exception of a school lunch menu on your kid's school. I mean, it's been that way for several years. It's a really good model. It's won some national awards. It's got everything from a little map that shows you where the school is or the district is, the demographics of the students, the teachers, the financial health of the district. It's got 5-year trends. It's got test scores. And now they've released like a new and improved model. So it's got even more data than before.
I've been hearing a lot about new information on how much each campus gets across the state. What did you find out there?
Okay, so what we've always had is how much each district gets. The new thing is that now it's down to the campus level so that you can tell, for example, in Springfield, how much the Springfield district gets, but then also how they apportion that out among the different schools. And they did it to meet a federal requirement, but the feds kind of left it up to each state on exactly how to calculate that amount. And it's really more complicated than you would think. It's not even something districts typically have done. Now that it's gone public, they're kind of cautioning people to use it as a way to start conversations, because it's not like buying a piece of jewelry where the place that has the highest dollar amount is the best thing. So it's the kind of thing that you shouldn't look at and make assumptions about. You need to explore a little further with your own school officials.
So is that the main thing that's new in this report card?
That's the main thing that the State Board of Education is talking about. There are other new data sets in this report card. One of them is the CRDC Civil Rights Data Collection. It's not a new data set. It's a federal data set. It just has not been on the report cards before. It tells you a lot about school discipline. It's got columns like the number of referrals to law enforcement. Of course, the highest was Chicago Public Schools with more than 3,000. The next two highest districts were in the kind of northwest suburbs. Actually, Springfield ranked 10th on this list with more than 2,000 out-of-school suspensions and 34 school-related arrests. So that's a data set that, you know me, I'm probably going to dig into that one.
Anything else jump out at you?
I like to look at kindergarten class size because, well, you just imagine yourself in a room full of five-year-olds, and you'll know why I focus on this. And I was surprised at how high some of the class sizes are. Some of them are over 30. We don't even have a law, but states that do have a law, like, you know, Ohio and Missouri, they cap it at 25. Here, the districts that have 25 or more in a kindergarten class, they tend to be heavily minority districts. They tend to only have 30% white kids when the state average is 48%. And one thing that's fallen is the percentage of black teachers. Almost 10% of our teachers were black in 2005, and this year, less than 6%.
That's Dusty Rhodes, our education reporter, taking a look at the new State Board of Education report card that's been released. Dusty, thanks very much.
Thank you.
If you'd like to read more about the new state report card, you can visit our website, statewideshow.com. There's a link there. Flu season is back, and for many people, that means it's time for your flu shot. It's also the time of year for schools to make sure students are immunized for other viruses, like measles. But what happens if they're not? And what is the state doing to get more vaccines to at-risk communities? Peter Medlin explains.
In 4 years of medical school, Illinois Director of Public Health Ngozi Ezike didn't have to treat a single case of measles. The World Health Organization certified the United States measles-free in the year 2000. But after an outbreak in New York that started last year, the U.S. came dangerously close to losing the designation. There have been 1,250 measles cases in the country this year, which is the most in more than 25 years. In Illinois, the percent of students who are immunized is still at the recommended rate. But last year, the number of unvaccinated students went up, as did the number claiming a religious exemption, according to state data. But Ezike wants people to know that the vaccines work. In fact, she thinks one of the reasons for the increase in unvaccinated students is that they might work too well.
They've become their own biggest enemy because they were so effective at eradicating diseases that were once commonplace that people have forgotten about the illness and severe sequelae that can come out of it.
So the state is working to make sure that low-income areas and other communities at risk have access to immunizations. Illinois kids under the Medicaid Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP, are now eligible to get free vaccines as part of the federally funded Vaccines for Children program. As for those religious exemptions, you can still get one in Illinois. Some states have eliminated the exemption in the past year. New York did so after some of the measles outbreaks were traced back to ultra-Orthodox Jewish schools who invoked the protections. Illinois did make the process to get one more thorough in 2015. Now, Ezike says, it takes a bit more than filling out paperwork.
And then it also involves your provider, your medical provider, to say that, yes, I understand this person is invoking this religious exemption, but I have counseled them again on the issue around immunizations.
Several private religious schools in northern Illinois have low immunization rates thanks to those exemptions. Notably in Chicago, Muhammad University of Islam has just a 10% rate, according to State Board of Education data. Rockford Christian Schools and Harvest Christian Academy in Elgin were among six Illinois schools with 40 or more religious exemptions last year. Both Harvest and Rockford Christian Schools declined interviews, but Rockford Christian Schools did send a statement reading, "Rockford Christian Schools allows religious objection to immunizations. RCS strictly follows the guidelines of the Illinois Department of Public Health for religious exemption. In addition, RCS encourages parents to have their children immunized and provides information to support vaccination." Other schools are complete outliers. Montessori Private Academy in Rockford had its immunization rate plummet over the last year. They went from having 3 students listed as unprotected and in noncompliance all the way to 78, and they only had 1 religious exemption. So what happened? Their executive director, Sue Haney Bauer, was just as surprised as anyone else when she saw it on the news. She says it isn't an accurate portrait of the school's real immunization rates. Haney Bauer wasn't the executive director when they turned in those numbers last year, but she thinks she knows what happened. She says it was because they didn't have a school nurse who knew how to handle the immunization reports.
I'm quite confident that we will be in the 90% rate again. It's a very complicated report. You know, if you don't have nursing staff, which many private schools do not, it could be quite confusing.
Some parents were also confused by it, and Haney Bauer says that's on the school.
We need to get our protocol in order and make sure that, you know, the information that we're providing represents our school.
While Illinois hasn't eliminated religious exemptions, Ezeke said legislation to do that isn't out of the question. And she says making sure immunization rates get as close to 100% as possible is crucial. This is especially to protect students who can't get vaccinated because of a medical condition. I'm Peter Medlin.
More solar panels are popping up on rooftops in Springfield. As renewable energy grows in popularity, the city's public-owned utility is working to change how they're built, as we hear from Mary Hansen.
I'm on the roof of the Carasotis building in downtown Springfield at the corner of 6th and Washington.
Overlooking the old state capitol and the new state capitol.
Michelle Knox shows off the solar panels.
We have a 9.9 kW system. It's a flat roof installation.
Knox is a renewable energy developer and head of Wind Solar USA. In her office, one floor below, she helps customers figure out the financing, installation, and maintenance of solar panels.
This system offsets about 25% of the building's consumption.
Those savings make the monthly city water, light, and power bill lower than it would be without solar panels. And thanks to a system called net metering, CWLP gives the building owners a credit when the panels produce extra electricity, which goes back to the city grid. But that's about to change.
This year, CWLP has implemented a new meter system.
CWLP now requires new solar installations to have 2 meters, one measuring all the electricity the installation produces, and the other measuring all the electricity a building is using. The electricity from the new panels goes straight to the CWLP grid instead of into the building they're on top of.
The disadvantage of the new system is that you can't always rely on the fact that you're going to be offsetting your consumption with the solar system's production that you paid for out of your pocket.
Right now, the city-owned utility is crediting solar customers for the electricity that's going back on their lines at full retail, exactly what you and I pay for a kilowatt hour produced by the city's coal plants or bought on the open market. But Knox worries CWLP might try to lower that rate, making solar panels a less desirable investment. And she's not wrong.
It's just not sustainable to do net metering for the long period.
That's CWLP chief engineer Doug Brown. He says net metering gives solar panel owners benefits at the expense of everyone else.
They're not paying their fair share of fixed costs, so the rest of our customers are subsidizing the solar customers.
In other words, the money it takes to maintain the system of cables, transmission hubs, and utility poles that bring electricity to your home, those solar customers aren't paying their fair share because they're paying less on their electricity bills, leaving those without panels to pick up the tab. It's an argument promoted nationwide by the utility industry, which calls it a cost shift burden, but it's controversial.
It definitely varies from utility to utility and based on the amount of solar that's actually installed already.
That's Autumn Proudlove with North Carolina Clean Technology Center, which examines nationwide renewable energy policy. She says studies done by environmental groups and policy centers show the so-called cost shift concern may be overstated.
If you have a state or utility territory where there's very little solar, there's not really going to be much of any cost shift burden.
Right now, solar accounts for less than half of 1% of electricity capacity in Springfield. CWLP officials say they haven't done a detailed analysis of the cost shift, but insist there is one. Proudlove says utilities should also consider the benefits solar panels provide.
So I think making sure that there's data and it's been thoroughly studied, and also ensuring that it's you have a strong grandfathering policy in place that customers that already have solar installed won't be subject to abrupt changes that they weren't seeing coming.
The only thing insulating solar customers from a credit drop is the Springfield City Council, which would have to approve any changes to how CWLP pays customers for the solar electricity they produce. Knox, the solar developer in Springfield, wants the utility to keep net metering for all smaller solar installations, the ones that power homes and small businesses. She says she's taken her concerns to council members and hopes they bring forward an ordinance in the coming weeks. I'm Mary Hansen.
Stay with us for more of Statewide. We'll hear about an effort to spread the word about the history of East St. Louis. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Our website is statewideshow.com. We have links to the stories you hear every week, and we have a podcast available through the NPR One app. On the way, paying homage to Illinois' rock and roll heritage with a new museum that's in the works. We'll explain. This past summer, a group of East St. Louisans embarked on an ambitious project to establish an organization that preserves that city's past and celebrates its success stories and cultural impact. The guiding spirit of the group is Reginald Petty. The East St. Louis native was a civil rights activist, a Peace Corps director, and advisor to several U.S. presidents. He spoke with Eric Schmid to explain why the East St. Louis Historical Society is needed.
I think many people do not really know much about the real history of East St. Louis in this area, and certainly don't know the history of the early African Americans who live in this area, the things that they went through. So we're trying to establish some institutions, some buildings where people could come and actually see East St. Louis past.
What is the form that this society takes?
We're in the process now of setting up, the routine 501c3 that one has to have, and we're still looking for documents of all kinds of going back to 1700s documents on East St. Louis and its history, and we want to make those available to people.
Why is knowing your personal history, your local history, why is that important for someone to know?
I think for a lot of people, a sense of who they are as individuals is really based to some extent on self-esteem, how they see themselves or how they have seen themselves or their families. The image that East St. Louis has had over time is a very negative image. What one often hears initially is, oh, it's a high crime rate. Oh, don't go to East St. Louis, you know. Be careful, you know. And people don't know that people like Ike and Tina Turner got their musical starts in East St. Louis, and they lived in East St. Louis.
What are some of the milestones that you want to hit, maybe 1 or 5 years out from now?
Well, one of the things we want to do for sure, we'd like to see a course prior to high school graduation on East St. Louis history.
Are kids right now getting that information?
No. This is nothing regarding East St. Louis history is included in our school systems. The problem is a lot of the information simply isn't known. It hasn't been gathered. East St. Louis is such a unique community, and there's so many unique people there. I think it's of value to people growing up now to know who these people are and their backgrounds and how they became who they are.
Can you describe a little bit of what it's like to see some of the youth here learn local history that they may not have known before?
You see the smile on their faces, and what I also see is a sense of, maybe if they did that, maybe I could do something like this. I'm getting that feeling of potential that they're beginning to see. And then we begin to talk about the importance of listening, the importance of learning. We begin to talk about colleges, and it opens doors to talk about the costs and saving money and some things that they could do during summer.
going back to the Historical Society, what's the one thing that people should know about it?
It is something that is critically important. We are talking about something that I think will be a model for a number of other cities around the country, because I think this is something that a lot of people in the Black community, in their Black communities, should know, that they should know their history and their data, and they don't. This is fairly rare, and I think this is something that we have in mind too as we move along.
That's Reginald Petty. He's talking about the effort to create the East St. Louis Historical Society. This is Statewide. One of the oldest Jewish synagogues in Illinois is for sale, and as Shayla Farzan reports, the temple in Quincy closed its doors earlier this year.
B'nai Shalom Temple was forced to close in May after the tiny congregation of about 12 people could no longer afford to maintain the building. The Quincy Temple was built in the late 1860s and features large stained glass windows and detailed brickwork. Congregant Andy Skatebo has helped to inventory historic artifacts in the building, some of which have been transferred to a Jewish archive in Cincinnati.
You find things that nobody's seen in years. So it's been kind of a little archaeology discovery project in a way.
The temple is listed for $150,000. The congregation, which now meets monthly in a local church, plans to use the money from the sale to maintain the nearby Jewish cemetery. I'm Shayla Farzan.
Every year, travelers from around the world head out on America's Mother Road. They flock to attractions along Route 66, and by this time next year, there will be a rockin' new stop along the road in Joliet. Kevin Dieber has more.
At the crossroads of Mid-America, in the heart of downtown Joliet, a group of entrepreneurs and music fanatics is determined to give an old building new life. Once the home of a furniture store and a boxing gym, the three-story structure built in the 1920s will soon house a museum.
I want them to walk out scratching their heads going, wow.
But not just any museum.
I want it to be interactive. I want people to be influenced by music.
A rock and roll museum.
Just kind of forget about our differences for the moment.
That's Ron Romero, president and founder of the Illinois Rock and Roll Museum on Route 66. He invited me to see the future museum. When we talked, the building was little more than a vestige of another time. Paint chipping off the ceiling, windows caked with dust. There was even a message written on the concrete left over from the building's days as a boxing gym. The message said, House of Pain. A lot of work lies ahead before the museum can open, but when it does open, Ron Romero hopes this project will focus on bringing us together.
It's not about race, politics, anything else. It's just music.
Some people might say, you know, we already have a rock and roll museum in Cleveland. Why do we need one in Joliet?
Actually, Cleveland was an inspiration. What makes us different is that we're specific to the state of Illinois.
Ron had something of a light bulb moment when he visited a pop-up exhibit in Rockford, Illinois, dedicated to the city's hometown rockers, Cheap Trick.
While I was there was a busload of people that had flown in from Japan to see it, and I was really impressed with the fact that they came that far for that specific thing.
Then Ron thought, Cheap Trick is just one of the state's great bands. Styx, Chicago, Smashing Pumpkins, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the list of great Illinois bands is long, but the space they occupy in the current rock and roll history is lacking.
There's a very long list of musicians from Illinois, and I just don't think that they got their due. Nothing's been really stored or maintained. There's no repository for the music of Illinois, so we want to become that place.
When visitors enter the Illinois Rock and Roll Museum on Route 66, they'll be standing on Maxwell Street in Chicago, at least a replica of it. That's where a major chapter in the story of Illinois music begins, on the south side of the Windy City. For nearly 100 years, Maxwell Street was home to a booming open-air market, and in the 1940s and 50s, it was fertile ground for the growth of rock and roll. In the first half of the 20th century, Black Americans moved en masse from the rural South to northern cities to escape Jim Crow, a movement known as the Great Migration. Black Southerners saw Chicago as a hopeful destination.
With that, they brought acoustic blues, Maxwell Street was a place where they could perform in front of people. The difference is that now they want to be heard. They can't go acoustic guitar, so now they're plugging in. And that became a little nittier, a little more grittier, and a little more aggressive. And we kind of took that music and made it Chicago's music. People like Willie Dixon and Buddy Guy and certainly Muddy Waters. And the music was there up until Maxwell Street closed its doors, so to speak. Not that they had doors, but but when they finally, closed up that area, there's still a prominent place for blues.
Out of a Southern tradition grew a new style of music. Chicago-style music.
We took something from the South, we brought it here, we kind of cultivated it a little bit, we made it a little bit edgier, and it made a difference because a lot of people wanted to come and hear it.
The edgy, raw energy of Chicago blues suddenly had a lot of people paying attention to the city of big shoulders, especially people from across the pond. American music, and Chicago blues in particular, influenced a wave of British music that flooded the United States. The British invasion.
Everybody remembers the British invasion. I like to say that the Brits invaded us with their own music, because they did. They came in, the Stones were recording a lot of the blues from Illinois. You go a little bit forward and you got like Led Zeppelin coming in there, taking licks from Willie Dixon. The influence that we created around the world kind of came back to us.
Why do you think that happened?
Because it was good music. there's no way around that. It's, blues, even the old blues, people still play it. People still love it.
The evolution of Chicago blues and the ensuing explosion of rock and roll is only one of the several chapters in the ongoing story of Illinois music. Ron wants the Illinois Rock and Roll Museum to tell as much of the story as it can, covering many genres, despite the words rock and roll in the title.
We just thought that might give it a little bit of sizzle. Rock and roll's a fun name. There's going to be country, there's going to be rap, R&B, gospel, any type of music that we can get in here.
An assortment of music, an assortment of stories. Ron is not worried about running out of material.
The nice thing about that is there's such a big list that if you come here once and you see something, we don't want people to go, we've already been there. We want people to go, hey, there's another new display, there's more artifacts that came in. And I think we have enough of that history here in Illinois that we can freshen up quite frequently and invite people to come back.
It's a big undertaking. On top of traditional exhibits and displays, Ron plans to curate interviews with Illinois artists, incorporate a live radio studio, develop programming to train people in audio production. There will even be a live performance area capable of seating about 300 people. Plans like these certainly require a lot of ambition.
More ambition than I have time, finances, and everything else. But that's all falling into place too, so.
Everything does seem to be falling into place. After a long fundraising campaign launched in 2017, a campaign that's far from over, Ron and his team finally acquired their building earlier this year. Renovations are underway, and they plan to open the first floor in 2020. The upper floors will follow in 2021. And with the surrounding downtown area's revitalized spirit, thanks in part to the restoration of the historic Rialto Square Theater just a block away, it really does feel like a case of right place, right time.
I can't wait to get the doors open and let people come in and see, what we've been working on and really be proud of what Illinois has for music here.
Not many people can say that they've founded a museum.
I sometimes pinch myself and said, what am I thinking, So it's been a learning experience and certainly bigger project than I originally thought it was going to be. But the more I get into it, the more I get pulled into it.
When the Illinois Rock and Roll Museum on Route 66 opens, It won't simply be a gift to the public.
When I saw what other cities were doing with music in the music museums, I thought, what a great opportunity for Joliet.
But also the fulfillment of one music fan's labor of love.
Through my whole life, my family were all musicians. I was a musician. I still play music. I still perform. And I have such a love for that, for music. And I don't know, I often ask myself, how is it that nobody came up with this idea before I did? You know, it's such a great state for music. I just don't understand. I guess I'm just lucky.
I'm Kevin Dieber.
That wraps up this edition of Statewide. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to join us for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois next week at this time. If you missed any of this episode or past shows, you can find them all at statewideshow.com. And don't forget, you can get our weekly podcast available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.